when I had that mystical experience, I experienced God experientially, not intellectually, and that's the God dwelling in within me. Then, unconsciously through the unconscious brain, and that's where my science came in, I started to recognize the God dwelling within others, and that's what launched me.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. Hey everyone, this is Stephen Cap Perry, host of In Good Faith. My grandfather was a physicist. Like, he worked on the atomic bomb in Los Alamos in the 1940s, worked at the Argonne National Laboratory with a particle collider, and then was head of the physics department at Utah State University. And so, because he was an expert in one area of science, he was often asked, well, how do you still have your faith? Because he was a person of faith. And so my grandfather wrote a book that is just on my shelf. It's kind of printed out in carbon copy, never published, but it's him talking about everything from the scale of the creation of the earth and how he tied it all together. So how do you put faith and science together? Like, do you see them as two ways to get to truth? And should they both agree when they get there? I've spent some time thinking about this, and I've loved having my grandfather's thoughts about it too, that I can look and think, wow, he was born literally in horse and buggy times and lived to see people on the moon and atomic energy. He had a big journey. And maybe we all have a bit of a spiritual journey in figuring out how we combine the ways that we discover truth. And one of them that is pretty new to me is the whole idea of contemplative prayer or the mystical experience. Talking with monks at a retreat, talking with Buddhists who put a lot of stock in what meditation does for them to calm them and grant them peace. And that's what our guest is talking about today. This is Dr. Robert Hesse from St. Thomas University in Houston, Texas, PhD in physical chemistry, but he has this whole life journey in his faith life as well. And we loved getting to speak with him and to hear a bit about a conference coming up in Rome on faith and science that's all based on his book.
I was reading scientists at the same time I was reading the mystics. And Einstein said the most beautiful experience you can have is the mystical. What I learned and realized is that a lot of the big paradigm shifts in science were taking place as a result of a mystical experience that the scientist had, even though the scientist may not have recognized it. And so I was attending conferences around the world in science and in faith, and in science and faith, in contemplation, all over the place. And I started to get a flavor for what was going on. And I realized that the conferences were siloed. They were not talking to each other. I was going everywhere. I was getting to meet the top people in each one of these fields. So then I go to Rome, and a friend of mine runs a couple of hotels over there. And I said, how do I get my book to the Pope? So he said...
Just a small goal.
Yeah, small goal. And you know what? Believe it or not, it's not an ego trip. When you found the pearl of great price, you want to announce it. When you've experienced it, you want to teach it. I go to Rome, and he sets it up for me, so I give it to the Pope. I don't expect that he read it, but who knows? But it was, well, I'm here, why not? So I get back to this guy's office, and he's a fascinating guy. He runs a music festival in Rome, all over Rome, every year for 20 years. And he said, would you like to attend a private concert in the Sistine Chapel tonight? And until you've experienced that, you have no idea. It's no crowded, people just around the bench. And as you wonder, angels are singing. So I come to his office and I told him about a conference in Dallas that Bishop Barron was putting on called Faith and Science. And it's sold out at 1,000 registrants. And so he says to me, why don't we do the conference here? Synchronistic. That wasn't my idea. That made me feel better about it. So a few minutes it took me, I thought about it, and I thought, we could do this. We could do it. So I decided that the agenda for the conference would be based on the four chapters of my book, which is Physics to Creation, Chemistry to Life, Biology to Consciousness, and Psychology to Mysticism. I got the top people from around the world, and most of them had never met each other. So I got three people who had studied under and working for Nobel laureates, plus the top mystics in the world that I was familiar with. We've got a Harvey Rosenstock, who's an MD rabbi Kabbalist, which Judaism is the equivalent of Christian mystic. Mm-hmm. And in Islam, it's Sufism. And I've got an imam, Jamal Rahman, who's a Sufi and in their tradition. And so each morning, they're going to start it out in silent prayer, because in the silence, there's no dogma that makes us interfaith. And these kinds of experiences I've had are experienced by other faiths. We're meeting God. God's meeting us.
You mentioned in the book an absence of about 23 years from the church. So I'm wondering if you can tell me, what was your early spiritual upbringing as you grew up? Then I want to jump to some very pivotal events that sort of brought you back.
My mother and father were cradle Catholics. They raised us wonderfully as devout Catholics, and that was part of the reason why I considered the priesthood. Then I went into the seminary for 6 years, studying for the priesthood. And after that, I was still studying, actually, when I left the seminary, because I wasn't finished at the end of 6 years, left the seminary. Then I was introduced to girls, which was a wonderful experience. And then dated and got married to my wonderful wife. But because of my experience, since we all have our own experiences, I left the Catholic faith for 23 years. Now, if somebody had said, "Are you Catholic?" I would have said, "Yes," but I really wasn't practicing, basically.
You speak quite movingly, and this is in one of the opening chapters, page 7 to 9. You talk about illnesses persisting in the family, both you and your wife as well. And then you have this beautiful section where you talk about reading The Seven Story Mountain, which is a Thomas Merton book, a Catholic contemplative priest, letting go of your thoughts and focusing on God alone. And you said, "This sounded like what I needed in my spiritual journey." And you launch yourself into reading about mystical experience, which I think we could define as between you and God with no intercessor.
That's what it is.
I wonder if you could tell me what that was like personally. What was that experience like to seek God in that way and make a connection?
It was life-changing. It redirected my life, and it drives me to this day. I was used to the meditation approach. Etymologically, that's engaging your thoughts either without using your lips or speaking, usually speaking to God. And I was used to doing that. That's what I was raised with. That's what most people are raised with. And I got tired of talking to God because I thought he already knew what I needed. Why am I telling him this? He's a pretty smart guy.
you are not the first person to have this cross their mind in prayer.
Well, and I was struggling with thinking I was in charge of the world and my health. And I was young, and I had all the answers. So that was there was never a problem until I got sick and my wife got sick. And that's the way suffering is. It gets your attention. And so I realized I was going to need a higher form of prayer than just telling what God what I needed to do, because he was smart. He already knew it. I had taken a retreat when I was studying for the priesthood at the Gethsemane Monastery where Merton was. I did not meet him, but he was writing a lot of books. I was searching for what he learned. And he was classic. He was known interfaith and world renowned, and had a sinful background like I did. So I thought, I can relate to this guy. And he started to talk about the other form of prayer that most faiths have, and that is not meditation, but contemplation. And contemplation is focusing on God alone without thoughts or words. And I thought, this is kind of what I was looking for. I wanted to hear what God had to say for a change instead of me talking to God all the time.
And when you did that, is it consciously sitting and being aware that God exists, that God is there? And do you have a moment where you feel some sort of contact that way?
Excellent question. There was only one line in Seven Story Mountain that alluded to how to do it. He never really had a method, Merton. from that one line, I went into a chapel where we exposed the Blessed Sacrament in the Catholic Church, and a very holy, sacred place. And it's silent. People are not talking in there normally. And I tried to do what I thought I knew I had learned. Mm-hmm. The problem was I was too tough. I was violent with my thoughts. And it becomes an issue of thoughts. Okay. In other words, whenever you become aware of your thoughts, you ever so gently let them go and return to your sacred word. And that's a symbol of your desire to be with God. Of course, I had a rush of thoughts, and I didn't know how to do this. So I was violent with myself. You know, I get mad and go back. That's not the way you do it, okay? But God was patient with me. And after my first attempt, for 3 days, I was in total peace. Total peace.
As you sat there and you're contemplating, you feel this change.
Well, you know, it's interesting. People ask about that and what experience it's like. And they'll describe two different things. And there are two different phases to this. One, it happens to most people. And that is, you experience the gifts of the Holy Spirit. And that's the best way to describe them. They're in Scripture. But in Scripture, there are a lot of different explanations of them.
Peace and joy.
Right, joy, wisdom. And God seems to know which one we need the most. And it's amazing. So that gift usually comes outside the prayer, amazingly. Not necessarily during the prayer. And so it was after I did that, that I experienced this tremendous peace. Because I was in turmoil.
Yeah.
And that lasted for 3 days. You could have slapped me in the face and I was smiling and didn't bother me. And that was the sense of it. And nothing got me upset because I could let it go. I could let it go naturally.
You wrote, this could be addictive.
Exactly. That's exactly what I thought. I thought, Bob, you better be careful here. What the heck is this?
If I could quote you, there's just something really beautiful you wrote here in just a few sentences. It says, I was completely unprepared for what happened there. It changed my life forever. It was a profound mystical experience. The result was I knew with absolute certainty that God loved me beyond my wildest imagination. God was preparing me for what I needed in my future life's struggles and joys. Was that for you as a scientist? Outside of your past experience, or were you trying to figure out what world you actually lived in?
I was living a schizophrenic life, basically, okay? Uh-huh. When I left the faith, I was very interested in science, so I was reading science and the latest scientific stuff. Then I had this spiritual experience, and that's where the convergence started to take place, because I was in a serious state of sin, so that's why I came to the conclusion God loved me in spite of what I was doing. Not that he was happy with it, but he loved me anyway. That's the key. Love me anyway. And that's profound. And then I started to read the mystics like crazy, trying to understand them while I still had this scientific interest in the background. And that's when I stumbled on Keating's book, Open Mind, Open Heart. That's where I thought, oh, this is what I've got to see. I finally found the answer. So what you're dealing with is the ineffable. It's a question of how do you describe God? Well, you don't, unless you are God. Okay. And so when I saw Keating's methodology of how to deal with thoughts, that launched me. And I was doing a lot of traveling looking for God anyway. I went to Snowmass, Colorado at the monastery there that was the Trappist Monastery where Keating was located. And that's when it launched me.
Are you 82, I believe?
I'm 81.
You're 81.
2 days ago.
Oh, congratulations. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
So you have lived long enough that you're on a hilltop that you can look over and see a larger view than most of us. And do you see God showing up as you look back, whether you knew it or not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I had, over my lifetime, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. So basically, I was doing a lot of different things. So I was negotiating international contracts on major capital projects around the world. What relevance would that have with my journey now? Mm-hmm. You wouldn't think any. Then it later became a tool for me to negotiate contracts to research on this prayer effect. These things were coming together. And I thought, I had no idea that I was being prepared in really strange ways. And the way God was speaking to me is the way, and it sounds corny, but it's not sound, okay? We all know that, I think. Mm. Although some people are still opening their ears up trying to hear something. And my science was starting to kick on because I was interested, how did this happen? And by the way, science is trying to answer the question how. Religion tries to answer the question why. Mm. And now the why and the how are coming together. And I really believe that it helps to have your brain and your soul in sync.
Yeah.
The sense of reason and spirituality have to be in sync. I think that helps tremendously. And how God speaks to me most often is through synchronicity. And you know what that is. It's several different people tell you the same thing. They don't know each other. And you're going, number one, it's not my idea. And whenever it's my idea, I got to worry about my ego getting in the way.
Uh-huh.
And I got three people who are telling me the same thing. And I'm going, better pay attention here. So God was speaking to me in that way.
So that's something you can learn to observe and to be aware of.
The key ultimate point where I really grew was when I had the mystical experience, which is different from the experiences that are outside the prayer practice. Mm-hmm. Mystical experiences can happen in the prayer practice, outside of it, anytime. For me and for people who practice this quite often, it's during the prayer, which is the distinction of the gifts of the Spirit. When I had that mystical experience and experienced God experientially, not intellectually, and that's the God dwelling in within me, then unconsciously through the unconscious brain, and that's where my science came in, I started to unconsciously recognize the God dwelling within others. And that's what launched me.
That sounds like almost like a consequence of those two great commandments, that first you connect with God, like first love God and then love others as yourself, that almost by making that divine connection, we're given the ability to see that or feel that for others. Would you say that's accurate?
Scripture reinforces this. It really does. One of the good examples of this is Mother Teresa. I have a lot of respect for her. Mm. And she wasn't just a mystic, but she got out and helped others. So to my mind, one of the things I see in this world on meditation, everybody gets excited about it, which is wonderful. But in my view, unless you launch that into service, you haven't gotten the full impact. And she would do this in the morning. She would practice her contemplative prayer in the morning and then go out on the streets of Calcutta. That's where it's at.
Definitely. In this research where you're seeing what contemplative prayer does to people's minds, can you share some people's experiences, what they've seen happen in their physical lives, in their spiritual lives, their connection with God?
Steve, thank you. That's the crucial question. Mm. So I'm in Cuba, and we reported on the research we did comparing brain scans of people who have had near-death experiences and people who have had mystical experiences separate from near-death. Mm. And in a sense, near-death is a mystical experience. And the brain scans show that they have similar attributes. So you shouldn't fear death. We were reporting the results, and the daughter of the organizer is a MD psychiatrist. And she invited me to her place to teach her family and friends interfaith centering prayer, which is the term that Merton invented, actually, but Keating gave methodology to. Mm-hmm. So I get there a little early. The daughter of the organizer of the conference, she said to me, by the way, one of the people coming suffers from Parkinson's disease. I said, okay. Didn't know what to say. Everybody shows up and I didn't notice which one it was. I couldn't remember. And I had to give my instructions in English because I don't speak Spanish. And suddenly, dog in the room jumped up into this guy's lap and that triggered a freeze. Now, in Parkinson's, they call it a freeze, but in layman's terms, it was a seizure.
Uh-huh.
So he's contorted pretty bad. I get in a silent mode of thinking to my mind in a discussion with God, which was more than a discussion. I was getting annoyed with God. I'm going, how do you expect me to do this, God? What do you expect me to do here? I get in an argument with God. And I tell people, it's always okay to argue with God as long as you lose the argument. That's it. And that the message clearly was proceed, or what I always forget in the moment is trust me. And I've had that come through. So I proceeded. And his wife is drying him off because his muscles are sweating. I gave a 10-minute explanation, which in a nutshell is this. You can do it pretty sharp. You pick a word or an image, but if you're a beginner, a word, a simple one-syllable word that has to have meaning only to you, and that is a word that is a symbol of your desire to be with God. That every time you become aware of your thoughts or become aware you're engaged with your thoughts, you ever so gently let go of those thoughts and return to your sacred word. So without saying anything, you're essentially saying that, God, I would rather be with my thoughts than your thoughts. Because God said, my thoughts are not your thoughts, said the Lord, right?
So interesting.
The only thing different I did in that presentation to them was I was assessing the situation. And I said, now, Jose, you are wanting to stop this seizure. That is a thought. You have to gently let that go. And I said to the others in the room, we want to help Jose, and we're thinking how we can help him. That's a thought. You have to gently let go of that too. Now, implied in that is we're turning over to God this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Without a lot of words, in fact, without any words. And I stayed more alert this time. Normally, I go deep. But when I'm teaching it, I try to keep an eye on people. And everybody went down with their hands on their knees, their eyes closed. And Jose is, and within a minute, he's down. And I'm dropping my teeth. I've taught it to people all over the world. And
yeah,
but this was a new one. I never taught anybody in the middle of a Parkinson's freeze. And I'm watching this, and I'm going, I don't want to bring him out of this. Normally, you do it 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of 20 minutes, I gently brought the people out, but very quietly, I left him in there. His wife left the room in tears. She had never seen anything like this. Mm. The doctors never saw anything like this. 15 minutes later, he comes out of it. Now, that made it, he was in there 35 minutes. He comes out of it. He gets up and gets this close to my nose and in passionate Spanish unloads. The doctor then translates. He said, when Castro took over, he took all the children into the countryside and purged them of their belief in God. I've been searching for God my whole life, and I have finally found him.
Mm, what a beautiful moment to be part of.
He and I both put our heads on each other's shoulders and wept. What else do you say? And that's classic contemplative. You run out of words. There's no words.
Yeah. And because you teach and facilitate this, I know that's just one of many experiences.
Oh, yeah. I wrote up a number of them in the website, contemplative.net, because the organization is actually Contemplative Network. And I've written up the anecdotal experiences in there and the research we've conducted and the published research in scientific papers. And at the end of the conference in Rome, I'm reporting on the results.
That should be interesting. Bob Hesse, fascinating to speak with you. I wish you and everyone participating the best. We are lucky because of you that you've connected us with a few of these people that will be talking about both scientific and contemplative aspects. And so we will have some of these coming up in the next little bit leading up to this conference, which is in Rome, June 17th through the 20th, based on this book, Faith and Science. What a pleasure to speak with you this morning, and thank you for speaking with me in good faith.
You're welcome. Let me tell you about the offsite just real quick.
Yeah.
Physics and Creation is going to be the Vatican Observatory, but we can't get to Castel Gandolfo in time, so it'll be virtual. Chemistry to Life will be a private concert in the Sistine Chapel. God Touching Man.
Yeah.
With music. Biology to Consciousness, the Borghese Gallery, where Bernini's sculpture of the mythological figures of Apollo and Daphne. And I hate to say this, but I don't want to turn people off, but it's the rape of Daphne, but she's escaping. Mm. So this is the birth of consciousness and free will. And then the small Maria della Vittoria Chapel where Bernini did a sculpture of St. Teresa of Avila in ecstasy, which is mystic hopeless experience. And he's a better sculptor than Michelangelo. And that's saying something. So it's really music, art, science.
Many thanks to Robert Hesse for speaking with me today in Good Faith.
This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Ebert, Katarina Martinich, Soraya Pearson, and James Sturdivant. Our post-production team includes DJ Cromarty, Gracie Davis, and Mark Hansen. Spread the word about In Good Faith by leaving a comment and subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. We think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. Our YouTube page is youtube.com/in-good-faith. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join us again soon, right here in Good Faith.
If you're like me, you want to stay informed, even about some of the tough topics that have to be discussed. But so much of the discussion just really doesn't move anything forward or generate light as much as heat. That's where Top of Mind comes in, a BYU original podcast. They understand how polarizing those kind of conversations can be, and they want to help us engage in that challenge while actually learning something. Their goal is developing empathy for others. Top of Mind can help you clarify your own views, become an effective advocate for the things you care about, and even challenge your way of thinking so you can become a better citizen, a kinder neighbor. Listen to Top of Mind now on the BYU Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.